Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
Live from the John L. Santikos studio, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Have we seen a third Reconstruction in America? Peniel E. Joseph argues that the third Reconstruction started with the election of Barack Obama in 2008, and it ended on January 6, 2021, with Trump's Stop the Steal insurrection. In his new book, The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century, he argues that America is currently living through a time that is just as significant as the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. Peniel E. Joseph joins us. He is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, and associate dean for Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the LGBJ School of Public Affairs at UT Austin. And Professor Joseph, welcome to The Source.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So walk me through these three reconstructions that we've gone through.
Well, the first period is going to be the period between 1865 and 1898. So those are the decades in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, which is from 1861 to 1865. The centerpiece of that first Reconstruction is going to be the Reconstruction Amendment, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. The 13th Amendment is the end of racial slavery, except in instances of punishment, which we'll get to later. The 14th Amendment is birthright citizenship and also the Equal Protection Clause. The 15th Amendment provides black men voting rights, but is going to pave the way for white women to get voting rights in 1920 and black women and really men again to get voting rights in 1965. And that period is going to be a period where we first see that real notion of multiracial democracy come through. So one thing that most Americans don't realize is that we're going to see about 2,000 black men elected to primarily local offices, local and state offices. There's going to be some congresspersons who are really going to be the people we most focus on, two black senators from Mississippi, an acting governor in Louisiana. But what's really the game changer is going to be the attorney generals, the magistrates, folks are sitting on juries. In Mississippi, for instance, there's 26 counties that are over 60% black that are just under black political control during the early years of Reconstruction. Even in Texas, Washington County, Texas, and other parts, we're going to see some black political power. And so in a way, if Reconstruction had worked, the idea of black citizenship and dignity becoming a central part of the American polity, we would have gotten to Barack Obama way, way before, maybe either by the early 20th century. But instead, what we get is redemptionists. And the redemptionists are these advocates of white supremacy. They're Confederates, but at times they're joined by Republicans. The Republican Party is both the grand old party of Lincoln, but it's also a party at times that collaborates with the South in order to get business done by the 1870s and the 1880s. So in a way, when we think about that Reconstruction period, we see the highs of black citizenship, the rise of black political leaders, even black wealth, where we'll see some black farmers who create really some empires in a way, agricultural empires and industrial and business empires. But we also see this huge backlash, right? And the backlash is fomented, one, at the grassroots level through racial terror and violence. In 1866 in Tennessee, two things are founded. One is Fisk University in Nashville, which is a historically black college and university that's going to train W.E.B. Du Bois, the foremost black intellectual of the 20th century and the co-founder of the NAACP. The other is going to be the Klan in Pulaski, Tennessee. That happens in the same year. So Reconstruction is filled with all these searing juxtapositions, right? So you're going to see both black citizenship and dignity, but you're going to see a huge backlash in the form of Klan violence, in the form of black codes and grandfather clauses that really circumvent the 14th and the 15th Amendments. And you're also going to see the rise of sharecropping and peonage, which really becomes slavery by another name. There's a great Pulitzer Prize winning book by Doug Blackman that came out in 2010, which is called Slavery by Another Name, and looks at the convict lease system. And what that was basically throwing black people in jail, including children as young as 8 and 9 and 10, and leasing them out to private companies that paid local municipalities for the labor. Most black people only lasted 7 years in those convict labor camps before they died. There was so much corruption and terror that happened. Hundreds of thousands of folks were caught up in that leasing system for decades and decades. So that's what you get during the first Reconstruction. And really, I end that first Reconstruction not in 1877 like most historians do, because of the election of 1876, the contested election between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel J. Tilden. There's 20 electoral votes that are up in the air. There's going to be a commission, and by 8-7, they decide that Rutherford B. Hayes is president, and he had 165 electoral votes. Samuel J. Tilden had 184, and the 20 electoral votes in 1876, the 270 that we need today was 185, and Hayes becomes president in exchange for removing Union troops out of the South forever. And that's how people usually end Reconstruction. But when we look at those next two decades, we do see archipelagos of black political power. One interesting case and really tragic case is going to be Wilmington, North Carolina. Wilmington, North Carolina, by the end of the 19th century, is going to be 43, 45, 46% black. And there is interracial power in Wilmington. There are black police officers. There are black lawyers. There are black people who are connected to the mayor's office. There is a black congressman, George C. White, who Wilmington is his district in Congress. He's going to be the last serving black elected official at the federal level in the South until 1970. And when we think about Wilmington, what we see is an organized coup in Wilmington of white violence through the spread of lies that black people are terrorizing white people in Wilmington. And the violence comes on Election Day, November 8th, and continues into November 9th and 10th in Wilmington, North Carolina. Over 100 black people are going to be murdered. Thousands are going to flee into the woods. President William McKinley is going to do nothing, and that's going to spark really the official end, I think, of Reconstruction, even more so than the Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896 that said separate but equal was constitutional.
Right, but so we did see with the Rutherford B. Hayes compromise of 1877, and on March 4th, when she becomes president, he recalls the federal troops from the South, and that's what people say. That's the end of Reconstruction, because the federal troops are gone, but the use of false electors from Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina, I mean, I found that to be interesting, seeing how false electors were part of what we're going to experience today with Donald Trump trying to retain the presidency under false pretenses. But we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll pick up where we left off. We'll hear about the second Reconstruction, then we'll get to the third Reconstruction. And we want to hear your calls. So our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Do you see any connections? Do you see a through line? Do you see history repeating itself when it comes to efforts to fight having a multiracial democracy in America? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line is Peniel E. Joseph. He is the professor at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the book, The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. He points out parallels, loops, things that have happened before, similarities in the history of the United States when it comes to trying to find racial equity, equal rights, equal access to the polls, multiracial democracy. If you've seen these patterns, you know, things strike you and say, I've heard about this. I saw this. I've been around long enough. I've seen this before. give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Professor Joseph, let's get into the second Reconstruction, and some of us are old enough to remember a lot of that.
Yes, the high points of the second Reconstruction are 1954 to 1968. You can certainly argue it begins before then in the 1940s with the Double Z campaign that black organizers start. Victory against fascism abroad, victory against racism at home, the struggles to integrate the military, which really are not going to happen until the Korean War and really the Vietnam War, and other struggles for just social and political and racial justice. But the reason why I started in 1954 and end the high point in 1968 is because 1954 is the May 17th Brown Supreme Court decision that says separate but equal is unconstitutional, all the way up until the April 4th, 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis. And in between that time, you see the assassination of Emmett Till in 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott in 55-56, the Little Rock Central High School crisis in September of 1957 that requires military intervention to desegregate Little Rock Central High School. We see the start of the sit-in movement, February 1st in 1960 in North Carolina, which leads to the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which becomes, by 64, the really potent interracial group of grassroots activists who are fighting for democracy. In 1961, we see the Freedom Rides, where future Congressman John Lewis is going to be beaten and brutalized. They're going to set fire to a Trailways bus and Greyhound buses in Anniston, Alabama by May 14, 1961. And these are integrated groups of bus riders who are trying to really show that an integrated group can travel throughout the Deep South. And they're going to be met by white mobs and racial terror that's going to make headline and global news. 1962, three people are going to be killed when James Meredith integrates the University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi. President of the United States is going to have to send hundreds of federal marshals that are deputized to get Meredith on campus safely in confrontation with Governor Ross Barnett. And that's going to be the confrontation that makes Kennedy see that the Reconstructionist history that he had learned at Harvard, which was the racist history taught at Columbia University by the historian Archibald Dunning, had been wrong, where they had said Reconstruction was bad, it was anti-white, the Klan were the heroes of that lost cause narrative. Kennedy, in his dealings with Ross Barnett, and he sees how Ross Barnett is calling him this radical traitor and this person who's not patriotic, and Bobby Kennedy, they're communists for wanting to uphold a federal decision to integrate University of Mississippi. Kennedy sees how he's been misled. 1963, of course, is the year of Birmingham and Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail. And the city commissioner, Eugene Bull Connor, a notorious far-right anti-communist, unleashes German shepherds and fire hoses on peaceful demonstrators. And that's going to be big, Dave, because that makes global news. And the pictures in not just the United States, but in France, the UK, India, when they show those German shepherds and white authorities unleashing German shepherds and fire hoses, the headline says savages. And I think it's one of the most extraordinary things in global history, because the people they're calling savages are the white authorities in Birmingham. This is 1963, and that's going to be the same year as the March on Washington. It's going to be the same year, which is August 28, 1963, same year James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time is published. It's going to be the same year, September 15th, that four preteen black girls are killed in a white supremacist bombing at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And of course, November 22nd, 1963 is going to be the day the world stands still because of what happened in Dallas, Texas, and President Kennedy is assassinated. 1964, we're going to see the passage of the Civil Rights Act on July 2nd. And we're also going to see Freedom Summer, where over 1,000 white volunteers go down to Mississippi alongside of black civil rights leaders to try to build freedom schools and register people to vote. 1965 is going to be the Selma to Montgomery demonstration. And, of course, Bloody Sunday, where future Congressman John Lewis is going to be brutalized on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Edmund Pettus, a Confederate military hero, trying to do a peaceful demonstration from Selma to Montgomery for voting rights. That is going to really be a game changer. Lyndon Johnson, a few days later, does a joint address to Congress where he says, we have to pass voting rights for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. He ends that speech with the civil rights slogan, we shall overcome. And of course, by March 25th, Dr. King does this nationally publicized address before 30,000 people in Montgomery, makes it to Montgomery safely. And that's going to lead to the passage of the Voting Rights Act on August 6, 1965. And so when we think about that trajectory, by 66, 67, 68, we start to see both political rebellions coming from economically impoverished and racially segregated neighborhoods that people euphemistically refer to as ghettos. Sometimes ghetto is a racial slur. Sometimes ghetto is an accurate description. A lot of times people talked about ghettos and how Jews were segregated in parts of Europe. And there are ghettos in the United States as well, in the sense that black people were forced through redlining and through other federal and state and local policies in to live in certain places. And when we think about the death of King, and King is leading a poor people's campaign, multiracial campaign, a mule train to go to Washington, D.C., where poor whites from Appalachia, blacks from Mississippi, Mexican and Filipino folks from California, indigenous folks from New Mexico, and demand a living wage and guaranteed income and health care for all Americans. And he's going to be assassinated in Memphis trying to help 1,100 sanitation workers achieve a living wage in 1968. We see that's the end of that second Reconstruction, the high point at least.
I'm going to get a caller in on this. Our number is 833-877-8255, and we have Scott. Scott, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. And Professor, I got a question for you. Do you see this simply as a racial issue, or do you see it in more of an education piece? I ask the question because of late, when we talk about social media, the current 24-hour news cycle, and now we have people using their loud social media presence as well as the news to perpetuate falsehoods, which prey upon people's confirmation bias and the use of some other logic fallacies to perpetuate things that are completely and totally false. Yet this led up to the insurrection on January 6th, and we almost lost our democracy. So do you see it simply as a racial thing, or do you see it as a lack of education? And the reason that some of these charlatans are using that, of course, is to remain in power.
Scott, thank you for your call. Professor?
Oh, no, thank you, Scott. That's a great question. You know, I see this as primarily an issue of democracy, but that race is at the center of our democracy. We've always been a racialized democracy by virtue of our origins as a republic of slavery and unfreedom. So in a lot of ways, everything that we talk about in the United States, if we talk about immigration, if we talk about reproductive rights, if we talk about environmental justice, if we talk about capitalism itself, race and really blackness and anti-blackness are at the core of that, because we've configured our structures and our institutions in society, our agricultural institutions, our industrial institutions, our institutions of higher education and healthcare institutions have been configured based on that racial caste system that emerges because of racial slavery. So these issues become one and the same. So sometimes we say something is a racial issue, but democracy is a racial issue. Healthcare, citizenship, voting rights, identity, dignity, these have all been racialized, not by black people, but by the histories that I write about in the book.
Another caller. Let's go to Daniel. And Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. Just a quick question for your guest. I've been listening to this conversation, y'all talking about the second Reconstruction. and all about these prolific people that were killed, you know, Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. And I'm just curious to know why and where does Malcolm X fit into that conversation? He didn't mention him at all. I think Malcolm is every bit as prolific as Dr. King, and that man was a complex person in his evolution and what he meant to the movement. So I'm just curious to know where he fits in all of this.
All right. Well, Professor Joseph, can we rethink Malcolm X?
Oh, absolutely. Malcolm X is a pivotal figure in the Second Reconstruction. I've written a book called The Sword and the Shield on Malcolm and Martin, and Malcolm is in the Third Reconstruction, too. What Malcolm X provides is this idea of radical Black dignity, I argue. And by radical Black dignity, Malcolm was talking about Black people affirming their own humanity and understanding that their lives and their histories had value in a way that didn't require the recognition of white people or the state or structures in that sense. So whereas King is the primary advocate of what I call radical Black citizenship, Malcolm is radical Black dignity. So in a lot of ways, Malcolm is pushing for a kind of political self-determination that pushes Black people to value themselves beyond the gaze of white people and the affirmation of white people, which is very, very important in a anti-Black racist society. And Malcolm is also very courageous in talking about structural racism and white supremacy in ways that at times the civil rights movement is unwilling to do so. Because until King's 3 years, King was interested in really radical reform, but not a revolutionary transformational politics that the times required. And by 65, after Watts, you see King turn, he tries to do a big movement in Chicago. That's not going to be entirely successful. And by 67, you see him push towards the anti-war, anti-imperialist, transformational, revolutionary figure, Poor People's Campaign. A lot of that is going to be, I argue, inspired by Malcolm X. And so when we think about Malcolm X, he's a revolutionary Black leader who's interested in Pan-Africanism, but he's also a revolutionary human rights leader. And he says that our problem is one of humanity, and it's a human rights problem. And so he's incredibly, incredibly important. And that idea of dignity is still important, because dignity for all people is the prerequisite to citizenship. You can't be a citizen if you don't understand that you have value and dignity as a human being. And not all families teach their children dignity, because some families have a problem with their children's sexuality or how their children look. So dignity is not a given in this society. So before you can have citizenship, you need dignity. You've got to value yourself. And that's what's behind the slogan, Black Lives Matter. That's a call for dignity even before citizenship. Citizenship is a part of it. And even saying all Black Lives Matter is a call for dignity, because it's trying to not exclude parts of the Black community that have historically been excluded, especially women and queer people, disabled and other people.
We're speaking with Peniel E. Joseph. He is the professor of history at the University of Texas, also the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values, founder, director of the Center for Study of Race and Democracy, associate dean for Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT Austin. His book is The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. We're going to continue our discussion with Professor Joseph right after this break. If you have a question or a comment about this pattern that we have in the United States, and we've just gone through the Third Reconstruction, and my concern is post-Reconstruction and how that has always been a really troubling time in American history. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a discussion with Peniel E. Joseph. He's the author of The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. And you can join the conversation. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can text us at that number. And you can tweet at us at TPRSource. Send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. We haven't even gotten to the Third Reconstruction yet, but I want to play a clip here. I think it kind of shows how there is a pattern here, that we are in kind of a time loop or maybe even a Groundhog Day sort of a situation, that things seem to sound familiar. And this is a clip from Angela Davis, recorded in 1972, a speech she gave. It's called Opposition, Oppression and Repression in the U.S.
The major problem we are confronting today, the major problem people throughout this country are confronting, is the problem of racism. And I think that if the last 4 years are any indication of what is to come during the next 4 years, we can indeed predict a very catastrophic period within the history of this country. Black and brown and Asian and Native American people have always been the first victims of oppression and repression in this country. But I think that white people in this country, particularly white working people, should begin to understand that they too are exploited and they too can be victims of repression. On many occasions in the past, and especially during this recent period after the elections, I have used the word fascism. I have talked about an increasingly fascist danger which people in this country must begin to come to grips with.
Professor Joseph, why is Angela Davis such an important figure here?
Well, I think Angela Davis really ties together three different generations of Black Reconstructionists. So Angela Davis, of course, is a Black power activist, but I think she's also one of the foremost theorists of democracy. And in 1971, when she was in prison and really had been accused by authorities of trying to aid in a prison escape that she was acquitted of and found not guilty of by 1972, but she was facing really a death sentence with three felony charges. And she writes an essay from prison about Black women during racial slavery, and she really pushes back against the Daniel Patrick Moynihan matriarchy thesis of 1965 and the case for national action that basically said the problem with the Black community was the makeup of the Black family, too many unwed mothers, and Black men who didn't have employment. And she shows what Black women were doing during slavery and how they fought for dignity and citizenship, even within the context of antebellum slavery, how they tried to do work stoppages, how they faced sexual assault. It's an extraordinary essay. And what that does is connect Angela Davis, who's around during the second Reconstruction, to both that first Reconstruction and pivotal Black women activists like Ida B. Wells, who I talk about, who's a criminal justice advocate, who's the anti-lynching crusader, who's a social scientist, a data scientist, who goes to sites of lynching and interviews people, reports what's happening, has to flee Memphis because of that, and really one of the foremost activists for justice and dignity of her age. It connects those two, but then there's a third one, and that's the third Reconstruction, where this new generation, who I write about, Tamika Mallory, Elisa Garza, Stacey Abrams, it connects them as well, because what you see is that this new generation is tied to this idea of abolition democracy. W.E.B. Du Bois, who's really the foremost intellectual of the 20th century, who stands right there alongside of William James, is the figure we usually think about the most here, because he wrote this extraordinary book in 1935 called Black Reconstruction. And in that book, he defies that lost cause Dunning School of History. That's published in 1935, right around the time that John Kennedy's actually in Harvard, at Harvard University, learning that racist Dunning School of History. And Black Reconstruction looks at the black women and men who tried to transform American democracy with honor and dignity. It looks at the elected officials who actually created the public school system in the United States, invested in infrastructure, invested in anti-poverty, only to, by the 1890s, be completely disallowed from having access to the reforms that they set in place for all people, right? And those are some of the ironies of history. And so when we think about that third Reconstruction, the four beats are Obama's election in 2008, the rise of Black Lives Matter in 2013, the rise of Donald Trump and MAGA in 2016, and then really 2020 and all the juxtapositions that we see in 2020, really through the present. I wouldn't say that, David, that it ends in 2021 with January 6th. I think it continues. I've just covered it through both January 6th and the I talk about Justice Ketanji Jackson and her confirmation hearings, but it continues. I don't think that it's over. But what's extraordinary about 2020, so much of American history comes into play in 2020. We see the juxtapositions of the pandemic and the racially disparate outcomes of the pandemic. Black and Latinx and indigenous folks are hit hardest by the pandemic. And then we see George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And we see this the largest social justice movement in American history, 25 million people out in the streets, including millions of white people, including places where there are really no black people or people of color who are protesting for Black Lives Matter, which is extraordinary and much different from the first two Reconstructions. But we also see the voices of black women in very, very prominent ways. We see Nicole Hannah Jones and the 1619 Project. We see Stacey Abrams and her organizing ability to get Ossoff and Warnock elected in Georgia. We see Black Lives Matter activists like Tamika Mallory and Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi and others who are really changing the narrative around what does it mean to be a citizen? What should democracy mean? Who should have access? Why is the criminal justice system a gateway to multiple systems of oppression that impact people's health, their education, their access to a decent and good life in the country? And how, if we push back against these symbols and substantively, and the symbols are the symbols of the Confederate flag, all these different monuments. We talked about the built landscape in the United States in 2020 in a way that we never did before. What we see in this third Reconstruction is this recognition of the power of narrative, the power of narrative, really on both sides, on the sides of Reconstructionist supporters of multiracial democracy, but also redemptionist advocates of white supremacy. And that's why we see such a huge controversy over so-called critical race theory, because the idea of teaching about black history and teaching about the Holocaust, teaching about Japanese internment camps, teaching about the Braceros program and teaching about what's happened to Latinx Americans, teaching about what we've done to queer folks and Asian American Pacific Islanders, what we've done to white workers, teaching all of that frightens people, right? It frightens people who are really advocates of redemption and the Redeemer South. And Make America Great Again was what I always called a nostalgia-driven time machine that wanted to transport all of us back to some kind of antebellum heyday that was never really a heyday. Even most of the white folks who wanted to go back to the Eisenhower era or go back further really didn't understand the context of those times. They weren't necessarily going to be times where they were going to wind up on the top of the heap. They just wanted a time when black people knew their place, which is really, really unfortunate. But we also found in 2020 the most outpouring for multiracial democracy that we've ever seen. And so I think it's very, very encouraging, even as we see voter suppression even as we see efforts to stop people from teaching history in K through 12 education, assaults on reproductive rights, assaults on so many different rights. Part of the reason those assaults are happening is that we have a new generation of young people who are really interested in telling a different story about American democracy.
Right. So, Peniel Joseph, you know, is there a connection? Do you see the loop between the Dunning School trying to romanticize the lost cause and trying to reconstruct that history and recreate it, and critical race theory's attack on critical race theory here in Texas? You know, is that a pattern?
Oh, absolutely. There's a direct through line, because what the Dunning School understood was that the only way that the South could win the peace after losing the war was by controlling the narrative. And that's what the Lost Cause does. It absolutely controls the narrative and says that the only way we can have national reconciliation between whites who fought on the side of the Union and whites who fought for the Confederacy was at the expense of Black citizenship and dignity. But the only way to justify that was by saying that the Civil War was a mistake, and also erasing the emancipationist legacy of the Civil War. And that emancipationist legacy is not just for Black people, because birthright citizenship has not just been used by Black people. The reconstruction of the South and the creation of public schools has not just been used by Black people. The investments in public education and infrastructure and roads and anti-poverty were not things that were just enjoyed by Black people. So when we think about this period, there's absolutely connections between those two.
We're taking a break. We'll come back. We're going to continue our discussion about the third Reconstruction. We'll talk about American exceptionalism. What is that? And is it actually a thing? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
50 years ago, a new political party was organized to bring greater self-determination to Chicanos in Texas.
The Raza Unida started because we were being ignored by the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They were not listening to us. We needed to have our own voice, and it's happening right now.
The Raza Unida Party, 50 years later, next time on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century, with the author of the book, Peniel E. Joseph. And so, Professor Joseph, what is this thing, American exceptionalism, and there's also Texas exceptionalism? And the history books in Texas have been rejected because they don't include enough of this. What is it, and how does that factor into a discussion of this third Reconstruction?
Well, American exceptionalism is the story that we tell about America, and a lot of politicians tell us this story too. It's a story we want to hear a lot of times, not the story we need to hear, that basically we're the greatest country the world has ever produced. And we're a shining city on the hill, like Reagan called us. Even though we might have had problems in the past, we fixed them, and we're constantly striving to perfect our union through the heroic, courageous work of usually white male leaders and patriarchal figures, whether that's George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, or just unnamed from tiers men, usually, who are all straight, by the way, because there's no sort of queer people in this exceptionalist framework, who paved the way and paved the frontier. We won't talk about the indigenous people who were there before everyone and what we did to them. We don't want to talk about slavery. We don't want to talk about the Klan and racial terror. So we don't want to talk about that bad stuff. So that narrative of American exceptionalism is this sort of mainstream narrative where we are always the good guys. The we is assumed to be white and patriarchal. And God wants us to have everything.
So is that how it works? We have this story of about how great America is, except for all these other things, and so we call it exceptionalism?
Well, we say we're exceptional. We're an exceptional nation because we are this nation of immigrants. We're exceptional because of how much wealth we've produced. We're exceptional for occupying so much of this glorious part of the North American continent. We're exceptional because of the Revolutionary War, and we were founded as a republic of freedom, even though we were a republic of slavery. All those things make us exceptional. I think that one of the things I argue in the book is that the problem with American exceptionalism is it's based on two big lies. The first lie is that Black people were not human beings, because that's how we became an exceptionalist nation, through racial slavery and an economy that thrived on racial slavery, irrespective whether you were a slaveholder or not. So there's great scholarship, Empire of Cotton by Sen Becker, The Half Has Never Been Told by Ed Baptist, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh by Dinah Rainey Berry, Capitalism and Slavery by Eric Fauner, by Eric Williams, books Reconstruction or The Fiery Trial by Eric Fauner, certainly Du Bois' Black Reconstruction, that lets us look at, when we think about racial slavery provided a context to create Wall Street. It provided a context for future investments by financializing Black people, putting out lines of credit on the monetary value.
It created a lot of our Ivy League schools.
Black people. It created Ivy League schools. That's Craig Wilder's Ebony and Ivy, which I would tell everybody to read. The Harvard University has just released and is publishing its slavery report that gets published in October as a hardback. So Georgetown has released a report, Brown University, University of Virginia. So we're all implicated. And this is global in scope, Dave. This is global in scope. This touches Europe. It touches Latin America and South America, the Caribbean. It touches everywhere. And so the only way you can get away with that and your origins be rooted in that is what people said was that Black people were not human beings. There was a whole racist science that said we were a species of property and not human beings.
And also a biblical line as well that they used to justify.
Ham, absolutely. The curse of Ham. We were the lost, cursed children of Ham. So anything but to confront what was happening in real time. And then the second lie is that the first lie never happened. So by the time you get to the 20th century and the Second World War and this idea of trying to fight fascism and a push more for multiracial democracy, no one wants to talk about racial slavery. So in Roots, when Roots premieres in 1977, Alex Haley's Roots, and 110 million people watch it, that's the first time in January of 1977 that the country ever tried to look at slavery, right? And ABC put that on over 7-8 nights consecutively because they didn't think anybody was going to watch it. And it became the most watched thing in the history of television at the time in 1977. So those are the two lies. And Texas becomes even more extraordinary. There's a great book by Annette Gordon-Reed on Juneteenth, which everybody who's a Texan should read. And it looks at, as those of us who live in Texas, it looks at the histories of Spanish, African, Native American and indigenous, and white, and how those histories collided, at times have worked together, but oftentimes have been histories of exploitation and violence and segregation. And Texas only wants to tell one part of that history, right? And so when we think about where we're at today, there are forces who are connected to redemption and the lost cause who want to continue to perpetuate the lie, but the truth actually makes us stronger. So telling a narrative of American history that focuses on the people, including white people, who were abolitionists, who were anti-racist, who did want everyone to have the right to vote and to create a multiracial democracy, actually makes us stronger. And criticizing Texas or the country is not based on not liking Texas. It's actually based on loving Texas and loving the country aspirationally, because at our best, we can be this shining city on the hill, but we've never been that shining city on the hill for all people. And telling the story of why that's the case is what's going to allow us to pick a different future.
Right. And so the Shining City on a Hill, like you said, it's Reagan's adaptation of the famous Puritan sermon saying that we are a city on a hill. And that was a warning, saying that the world is watching and they will see our sins as we are developing this new world. And so these sins, though, they have to be witnessed. They have to be experienced. They can't be just washed away.
No, absolutely. And one of the things that we see with this third Reconstruction is that we are talking about these issues for the first time nationally with more candor than ever before. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to agree, but the only way you could even get to a new consensus about what American identity and to move beyond American exceptionalism, to still have a narrative that we can all be united around, but one that goes beyond an American exceptionalist framework, because that framework does all of us a disservice because it thinks we're not strong enough to know the truth about the country.
I'm going to try and get one more caller in. This is Francisco. Francisco, go. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to come and say that critical race theory, I think it's good that it is taught because it explains a lot about our history. Because growing up in my education system, we got the watered-down version of history. You know, you don't get the whole all facts. So I think it's a good idea that it's taught. Some people in the past have tried to outlaw it and try to say that it radicalizes people. I think there could be some checks and balances where you can not charge the student to, for another humanities class and maybe just try to balance out or at least get another frame of thought in there.
All right, Francisco, thank you for the call. So, you know, if you know these things, what do you do with all the information that you have in your book, Pinnell?
I think the first thing that you do, and people have been asking me this, is that you share the story with your children, your family, wherever you're at. You know, I mean, it's not just about like running for office and going to the city council meeting. Part of what makes us all tick as human beings, not just as Americans, is stories. And what I try to do here is contribute to really a larger story of American history and American democracy. How do we come together to build the beloved community that Dr. King talked about that was free of economic injustice, free of racism, free of violence and war and misery? And the biggest way we can do that is by not only confronting the sins of the past, but also valorizing the folks in the past and the present who've wanted transformational change. Those folks who led us to the 8-hour workday, those folks who are environmental justice advocates, those folks who are advocates for the rights of women and people who are in prison and people who are disabled and people who've been marginalized in our society. Oftentimes, those folks have been women, oftentimes women of color, oftentimes black women. What happens when we make them a central part, a central spoke of the story and co-architects of American democracy, which is what I do here?
All right, so I'm almost out of time. I want to get this last real quick question. I have about a minute left, but I want to ask you, we keep hearing about a new civil war. Is this new civil war going to be about trying to prevent multiracial democracy?
Well, yes. I mean, the Civil War is always about whether we're going to be a multiracial democracy or we're going to be a white ethno-nationalist state. So absolutely, it's always about that. I would say in terms of this idea of civil war, I think what we should be focusing on is how do we co-create a future that builds consensus towards an America where we're not anxious and fearful of each other and talking about civil war as some kind of solution. War is never a good solution. Violence is never a good solution. What we should be trying to do is achieve a country together that prevents us from falling back into those old unhappy patterns.
Pinnell E. Joseph is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of the book, The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. It was great having you on. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Dallas Williams and Megan Halbadier Moore, with production assistance provided by Mark Hutchison. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.